in which all of our science departments came together to explain and demonstrate their research. The highlight of the event was a lecture by physicist Jim Al-Khalili. Jim is a professor of theoretical nuclear physics at the University of Surrey, where he holds the chair in the public engagement of science.
He has hosted many BBC productions, including Atom, Chemistry, A Volatile History, and Everything and Nothing, amongst many others. He's also the author of many popular science books. Paradox, The Nine Greatest Enigmas in Science, is his latest and was also the title of his lecture. We were lucky enough to get 15 minutes of his time to find out about the young Jim Al-Khalili, his early career, and his dual life as a researcher and science communicator.
When you were little, what did you aspire to be when you grew up?
Well, it depends how old you mean when I was little. When I was about 10, I had it all mapped out. I knew I wanted to do something sort of clever. I wanted to be a brain surgeon for some weird reason in the day. And then I was going to play for Leeds United the weekend. And then I was going to be a rock star in the evening.
So that sounds really good.
It sounds really good. It hasn't planned out the way I thought it would. But it wasn't until about 13 or 14 that I started getting more interested in science, specifically in physics.
So what was it that actually sparked your interest for physics?
I think as with a lot of people, it was an inspiring teacher. Remember, I did a class test and that I did really well in physics. I remember the teacher taking me out to the front of the class and sort of patting me on the head in front of everyone else. And you know, it could have gone either way. I could have either wanted a hole in the ground to appear or felt really pleased with myself. And it was the latter. I thought, my friends hadn't done well. And I thought, oh, physics, maybe I'm really good at this. And somehow it made me big-headed enough to think that was the direction I wanted to go in, and I sort of didn't look back.
Was there a particular area of physics you were interested in at that age?
No, not really. It was my brother. I've got a younger brother who was into astronomy, so he had the telescope. He was into all that stuff. I didn't have any specific areas of physics. I knew I wanted to do physics for the rest of my life. It's quite sad, really.
It's not.
I'm in good company.
You're not alone. So what kind of brought you towards nuclear physics? At what point? Was it during your degree that you...
Well, I did my degree at University of Surrey, so I'm still there now. And I had, after I graduated, got a job lined up in the civil service, National Physical Laboratories, in the civil service scientist job. And then... one of the professors at Surrey that I'd done my final year research project with asked me if I would consider staying on doing a PhD, and he was a nuclear physicist. And I hadn't until that point really thought carefully about what I wanted to do. I was getting married after I graduated. Mm-hmm. So a girlfriend I've been going out with since we were 18. Sort of finishing university was a good time to get married. So I thought, now I've got to get a grown-up job, I've got to get a mortgage and do all that stuff. But then I thought, well, no, actually, a PhD is what I really... that sounds like a good idea. So I didn't bother looking elsewhere in particular areas of physics. This was a PhD given to me, handed to me in my lap the opportunity, and it was in theoretical nuclear physics. So I said yes. And sort of then once you head off in that direction, you sort of narrow down your options to some extent.
Yeah. So did you do your undergrad as experimental or theoretical?
It was both until the final year. So I mean, obviously, you know, you do lab work and you sort of... I didn't have a preference, but the degree I did was a 4-year sandwich course. So I had a professional training year where I worked in a lab, and came very close, various mishaps to, you know, electrocuting myself. I was cleaning out the insides of the vacuum chambers with sort of very high voltage electrodes, and it's something called thin film sputtering, where you sort of, you know, coat materials with very thin, fine film. And so it's done inside this vacuum bell jar. Mm-hmm. And whenever you do a run, you have to sort of get it back up to air pressure, take it off and clean it all. And I remember cleaning it once without unplugging, without switching it off, and realised I could have, you know, been zapped with several thousand volts.
Well, you propelled very far by that.
I could have been, luckily, but I went weak at the knees. And I think it was occasions like that where I thought, well, maybe I'm not safe in a lab. Maybe I should do theoretical physics and do that. So when I came back to do my final year, I chose all the mathematical theoretical physics options.
That sounds very much like me. In labs, I drop things and break things. I'm much happier with just somebody giving me a graph and I'll leave things with
it. Nothing to be ashamed of.
It's reassuring.
So at what point during your beginning of your physics career did you develop an interest in communicating what you did?
I guess I would have been a postdoc. I'd done about three, after my PhD, I did 3 years as a postdoc, 2 years at University College London, and then came back to Surrey. And it was very much the, you know, you write up papers and you go to conferences and so on. But I started doing the odd schools talk or interview local radio. I started to become the person that the press officers in the university would come to if there was a science story, because I enjoyed explaining the science. And I think it's partly because most of my social circle of friends weren't physicists, weren't scientists. So I was used to talking to friends down the pub, you know, at a level that aimed at non-scientists. So I enjoyed that. And it just gradually developed. It was never something I didn't sort of imagine years down the line. No, not at all. No, it was just, it was a hobby that I did that just gradually built up.
And what do you think it is that makes somebody a good communicator of science?
There are different kinds of communicators. I mean, a good communicator also means a good teacher. And so someone who can get an idea across is what we mean by communicator. But a lot of scientists, a lot of people who are specialists in a particular field, find it difficult to empathize with an audience, to imagine what they might know. So for me, it's about putting yourself in the audience's shoes. How do they see the subject? I'm not cleverer than them. You know, they're not stupid. It's just they don't speak the same language, the technical language. So it's, how do you put an idea across in a way that different audiences can understand? And there are different, there are communicators who are good with kids. There are others who are, you know, who are good with their own students. I mean, there's different ways of communicating.
Do you have any tips for any young scientists that wish to get involved in journalism and communicating to the general public?
Well, it's becoming very popular now. Science communication is becoming more respected. When I started off seriously doing sort of science communication and outreach, and sort of about 15, 16, 17 years ago, it was to some extent frowned upon. And particularly at that stage of my research career, when I was very research active and going to conferences and publishing papers, science communication was seen as a distraction for a serious scientist, and I was warned off it. Things have changed completely now. Now it's regarded, not completely among all scientists, but most scientists acknowledge that it's actually an important part of what scientists should do. Not everyone can or should do it, but many more than do should be more involved. So it's much more respectable. So I would encourage people to be more involved. It depends what you want to do. I couldn't see myself as giving up on the serious science itself, teaching and research. I wouldn't want to just be reporting on other people's science. I want to be doing it as well, because I still enjoy that. So my advice would be, it is possible these days to do both, to have a career in science, whether it's in industry, whether it's in academia, whether you're a researcher, and be involved in communicating, learning how to talk to journalists, learning how to write popular articles. That's also very fulfilling. And I find sometimes, you know, I can spend months with my colleagues doing research and writing up a scientific paper in a journal that's read by half a dozen people. Then I can spend an afternoon writing an article for a newspaper that's read by 500,000 people. You know, and you realise it's not a numbers game, because obviously scientific research has to be built on that incremental working hard, publishing a paper. But it's just as fulfilling to be able to get across those ideas to the public.
Is it quite a different balancing act between the two lifestyles when you're out filming and communicating? And do you find your research, do you feel like you're abandoning it at all?
It can feel like that. But I mean, in many cases, you get to a certain stage in mid-career, you know, where it does become hard to find the time to do the research anyway. Very often, you know, you might be, as an academic, involved in more administrative duties. And it's just as hard. You're endlessly sitting in, you know, management meetings or finance meetings where, you know, you don't get the chance to sit down and think, or go off and do an experiment, or write a paper. So you will always have those pressures on your time. You'll never recapture that time when you could just devote, you know, every day entirely to thinking and doing research. I did find it difficult to begin with to find a balance, but I think I've pretty much you know, I've got a full diary in this, you know, that I'm a, you know, I still teach, I still do the research, but I do a lot of sort of the writing and broadcasting. But there's a sort of sensible balance tension there that I've managed to achieve.
What are you currently researching in?
Well, I'm part of the theoretical physics research group at Surrey. So I've got two PhD students. One is, and a lot of, you know, essentially much of my research now is through my research students. So I've got two students, they're working on two separate areas. One is doing sort of more traditional nuclear physics, the sort of stuff that I've published most of my research in over the years, modelling nuclear reactions. The other is working in a new area of research, which is sort of a growing interest to me, in quantum biology, which is essentially using some of the theories and mathematical techniques that we've used in nuclear physics and applying it in microbiology. That's sort of a new, it's speculative, but it's a very exciting new area of research. Mm-hmm. It turns out a lot of biological processes, nature seems to have evolved ways of using basically quantum mechanics in a very clever way. We tend to use quantum mechanics in physics. Biology is all messy and complicated and difficult to understand, but there are certain processes down at the molecular level inside cells that you can only explain if you use quantum mechanics, and that's sort of quite exciting. So biologists don't know quantum mechanics, so we help them out and get patted on the back for it. So I've got a student who's working in that area now as well.
Oh, that's very interesting. We've got some quickfire questions.
Right, I'll give quickfire answers then, presumably.
Yeah. I did a little survey on the guys in my year and it said if they could ask you a question, what would it be? So we've got a bit of a mixture.
Okay.
Which football team do you support?
Leeds United.
Brilliant. Oh,
goodness me.
Leave that in.
Yeah.
What's your favourite Star Wars character?
Yoda.
Cool, I think that would go down well. What would be your desert island record?
Well, actually, I'd have to be... I remember what I did, because I've been on desert island discs, and what I said was... it's a Santana track, She's Not There.
Okay. What do you think you would have done if you didn't do physics?
Oh, do you know what? Probably... And this is something only in recent years I've sort of realised I would really enjoy. Something to do with ancient history.
Okay.
I hated history at school, but I've sort of gradually developed a love of history later in life. And so I said, if I had the chance, I think there's something liberating about doing history, which is very different to science. In science, you know, you're either right or you're wrong. In history, you can have any opinion you like. You can, I'm going to quote this source, not that source, and it's you can say what you like. So, but there's something about, you know, ancient history that I find there's something sort of quite magical about it.
Fantastic. I'd have to agree. Do you want to ask some questions?
Do you have a favourite physical constant or one that you'd like to see changed just to see what happens to the universe?
A favourite physical constant? Ooh. Well, it'll be interesting to see what would happen if Planck's constant was much bigger.
Right.
Cool.
Excellent.
And what's your favourite physics joke?
Favourite physics joke? I can give you my least favourite physics joke.
Yeah?
The barman says, what will you have? A neutrino walks into a bar.
Yeah.
I hate that. Okay, no, don't laugh. Don't laugh. That's you know, that's very not funny, especially as I was bombarded with it many, many times on
two
Twitter.
Two of our lecturers came into the lecture theatre and each one of them said that same joke in the lecture. And
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think there are any good physics jokes, to be honest.
No.
You know,
that's what's good about them,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. They're all things to do with charge and that sort of thing. Neutrino, proton, they're not funny.
Okay, well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Perfect Squares. For more information, please visit our website at www.perfectsquares.net.